Sunglasses sat like a bow across her head. Having come in from digging, she had nails that looked as if she'd just had a set of French tips done in dirt. Her handshake was faintly gritty, and her eyes raked my face with interest. "I'm Lena. How are you?" "I'm fine. Sorry to interrupt your gardening," I said. Her wave was careless. "Garden's not going any place." I was glad to take a break. "That sun out there is murder. Jerry mentioned this business about the Jaffees."
"Wendell Jaffe in particular. Did you know him?"
"We knew of him," Lena said.
Jerry spoke up. "We know her to speak to, though we tend to keep our distance. Perdido's a small town, but we were still surprised when we heard she'd moved in over there. She used to live in a nicer area. Nothing fancy, but better than this one by a long shot."
"Of course, we always thought she was a widow."
"So did she," I said. I gave a quick synopsis of the rumored change in Dana Jaffe's marital status. "Did Jerry show you the picture?"
"Yes, but I haven't had a chance to study it."
Jerry straightened the flyer on his desk, lining up the page with the bottom edge of his blotter. "We read about Brian in the papers. What a mess that boy's made. We see police over there every time we turn around."
Lena interjected a change of subject. "Would you like a cup of coffee or some lemonade? Won't take but a minute."
"I better not," I said. "I have a lot of ground to cover yet. I'm trying to get these flyers out in case Wendell puts in an appearance." "Well, we'll certainly keep an eye out. This close to the freeway, we get a lot of cars through here, especially during rush hour, with people looking for a shortcut. The southbound off-ramp's just a block in that direction. We have a little strip mall down the street, so we get foot traffic, too."
Lena added her comment, cleaning dirt away from her cuticles. "I run a little bookkeeping business from my office up front, so I'm sitting near a window several hours a day. We don't miss much, as you can probably tell. Well, now, I'm glad we had a chance to meet. I better finish up out back and get some work done since I mentioned it."
"I'll be on my way then, but I'd sure appreciate the help." She walked me as far as the front steps, a copy of the flyer and my business card in hand.
"I hope you don't mind my getting personal, but your first name's unusual. Do you know the origin?"
"Kinsey is my mother's maiden name. I guess she didn't want to lose it, so she passed it on to me."
"The reason I ask is that's what Jerry's been doing since he took early retirement. He researches names and family crests."
"I gathered as much. The name is English, I think."
"And what's the story on your parents? Do they live here in Perdido?"
"Both died years ago in an accident. They lived up in Santa Teresa, but they've been gone now since I was 5.
She pulled her glasses down from her head, giving me a long look above the half-moon of bifocal lenses. "I wonder if your mother was related to Burton Kinsey's people up in Lompoc."
"Not as far as I know. I don't remember any mention of a name like that." She studied my face.
"Because you look an awful lot like a friend of mine who's a Kinsey by birth. She has a daughter just about your age, too. What are you, 32?
34, I said. "But I don't have any family left. My only close relative was my mother's sister, who died 10 years back."
"Well, there's probably no connection, but I just thought I'd ask. You ought to have Jerry check his files. He has over 6,000 names in his computer program. He could research the family crest and run off a copy for you."
"Maybe I'll do that the next time I'm down. It sounds interesting." I tried to picture the Kinsey family crest emblazoned on a royal banner. I could probably mount it near the suit of armor in the Great Hall antechamber. Might be the perfect touch on those special occasions when one hopes to impress.
"I'll tell Jerry to do the research," she said, having made up her mind. "This is not genealogy. He doesn't trace anybody's family tree. What he gives you is information about the derivation of the surname."
"Don't have him go to any trouble," I said.
"It's no trouble. He enjoys it. We work the art show up in Santa Teresa every Sunday afternoon. You ought to stop by and see us. We have a little booth near the wharf."
"Maybe I'll do that. And thanks for your time."
"Happy to be of help. We'll keep an eye out for you."
"That's great. And please don't hesitate to call if you see anything suspicious." "We surely will." I gave her a quick wave and then moved down the porch steps. I heard the door close behind me as she went back inside. By the time I distributed flyers up and down the block, a locally owned moving company with a bright red van had arrived at Dana's house, and two burly guys were in the process of angling a box spring down the stairs. The screen door was propped open, and I could see them struggle with the turn. Michael was pitching in, probably in an effort to speed the process and thus cut costs.
A young woman, I guess to be Michael's wife, Juliet, wandered out of the house from time to time, the baby on her hip. She'd stand out in the grass in a pair of white shorts, rocking and jiggling the baby while she watched the movers work. The garage doors were open, a yellow VW convertible parked on one side, the back seat piled high with the sorts of odds and ends no one wants to trust to the movers. There was no sign of Dana's car, and I had to guess she was out running errands. I unlocked my car door and slid onto the driver's seat, where I busied myself. No one seemed to pay any attention to me, too busy loading furniture to notice what I was doing. Within an hour, the truck had been packed with whatever furniture the couple was taking with them. Michael, Juliet, and the baby got into the VW and backed out of the driveway. When the van pulled away from the curb, Michael fell in behind it. I waited a few minutes and joined the motorcade myself, keeping several car lengths between us. Michael must have known a shortcut because I soon lost track of him. Fortunately, the van wasn't hard to spot on the highway up ahead. We drove north on 101, passing two off-ramps. The truck took the third, turning right, and then left on Calistoga Street, proceeding into a section of Perdido known as the Boulevards. The van finally slowed, pulling into the curb just as the VW appeared from the opposite direction. The house they were moving into looked as if it had been built in the 20s. Rosy beige stucco exterior with a tiny porch and a patchy front yard. The window trim had been done in a darker shade of rose with a tiny rim of azure. I'd been in half a dozen houses just like it. The interior couldn't have been much more than 900 square feet. Two bedrooms, one bath, living room, kitchen, and a small utility room in the rear. There was a cracked concrete driveway to the right of the house, a two-car garage visible in the rear with what looked like a bachelor apartment above. The movers began to unload the truck. If they noticed my presence, they gave no indication of it. I made a note of the house number and the street before I fired up my engine and returned to Dana's. I had no compelling reason to talk to her again, but I needed her cooperation, and I was hoping to establish a rapport of some kind. I caught her just as she was turning into her drive. She parked the car in the garage, assembling some parcels before she opened the car door. The minute she spotted me, I could see the color tint her cheeks. She slammed her car door, emerged from the garage, and crossed the grass in my direction. She was wearing tight jeans, an old T-shirt, and tennis shoes, her hair held back by a blue and white cotton scarf that she had tied around her head. The assorted paper bags in her arms seemed to crackle with her agitation.
"What are you doing back here again? I consider this harassment."
"Well, it's not," I said. "We're trying to get a line on Wendell, and you're the logical place to start." Her voice had dropped, and her eyes were glittering with rage and determination.
"I will call you if I see him. In the meantime, if you don't stay away from me, I will notify my attorney."
"Dana, I'm not your enemy. I'm just trying to do a job. Why don't you help me? You're going to have to deal with the issue sometime. Tell Michael what's going on. Tell Brian, too. Otherwise, I'm going to have to step in and tell them myself. We need your help on this." Her nose suddenly reddened, and a fiery triangle formed around her mouth and chin. Tears leapt into her eyes, and she pressed her lips together, sealing back her rage.
"Don't tell me what to do. I can handle this myself."
"Look, can we talk about this inside?" I saw her glance at the houses across the street. Without a word, she turned and proceeded toward the front door, pulling keys from her shoulder bag. I followed her through the entrance and closed the front door behind us.
"I have work to do."
She dumped her parcels and handbag on the bottom step and went up the stairs toward the second-floor bedrooms. I hesitated, watching her until she disappeared from view. She hadn't said I couldn't join her. I took the stairs two at a time, peering right at the landing until I located the empty master suite that Michael and his wife had apparently just vacated. There was a canister vacuum cleaner outside the door, cord neatly retracted, cleaning tool still attached. My guess was that Dana had left it there as a tangible suggestion, hoping someone would vacuum once the furniture had been moved. No one seemed to have taken her up on the offer. She was standing in the middle of the bedroom, surveying the premises, trying, I imagined, to figure out where to begin the cleanup. I eased into the doorway and leaned against the frame, trying not to disturb the fragile truce between us. She glanced over at me without any evidence of her earlier hostility.
"Do you have children?"
I shook my head.
"This is what it looks like when they leave you," she said.
The room was drab and empty. I could see a king-sized square of clean carpet where the bed had been. There were stray coat hangers on the floor, and the wastebasket was jammed with last-minute discards. Nests of accumulated hair and fuzz rimmed the wall-to-wall carpeting. There was a broom leaning against the wall, a dustpan upright beside it. There was an ashtray on the windowsill, the brim filled with old cigarette butts, an empty crumpled pack of Marlboro Lights balanced jauntily on top. Pictures were gone. I had to guess the young married couple was still at the stage of decorating where travel or rock posters were affixed to the walls with tape. I could see the patches left behind. The curtains were down. The window panes were lacquered with a gray film of cigarette smoke, and I guessed the glass hadn't been washed since the kids moved in. Even from a distance, Juliet didn't strike me as the sort who scrubbed the baseboards on her hands and knees. That was Mom's job, and I suspected Dana would tackle it with a vengeance once I had finally left her in peace.
Help yourself. She grabbed the broom, attacking the corners of the room, coaxing dust away from the walls.
While she exhumed the remains of Michael's presence, I moved into the bathroom. The area rug and the towels had been removed. The door to the medicine cabinet was hanging open, the interior empty except for a sticky circle of cough medicine on the bottom shelf. The glass shelves above were tacky with dust. The room echoed oddly without the softening influence of a shower curtain. I used the last scrap of toilet paper and then washed my hands without the benefit of soap, drying them on my jeans in the absence of a hand towel. Someone had even taken the bulb from the fixture. I moved back into the bedroom, wondering if I should help. There was no sign of a dustcloth or a sponge or any other cleaning implements. Dana was going after the dust as if the process were therapeutic. "How's Brian doing? Have you seen him yet?"
"He called me last night when he'd been through the booking process. His attorney's been in to see him, but I'm really not sure just what they discussed. I guess there was some kind of problem when they brought him in, and they put him in isolation."
"Really?" I said. I watched her sweep, the broom making a restful, scritching sound against the carpet. "How'd he get into trouble, Dana? What happened to him?" At first I thought she didn't intend to respond. Dust appeared in little puffs as she swept it away from the wall. Once she completed her circuit of the room, she set the broom aside and reached for a cigarette. She took a moment to light it, letting the question sit there between us. She smiled with bitterness.
"It started with truancy. Once Wendell died, well, disappeared, and the scandal hit the news, it was Brian who reacted. We used to have huge battles every morning about his going off to school. He was 12 years old, and he absolutely did not want to go. He tried everything. He'd claim he had stomach aches and headaches. He'd throw temper tantrums, cry, he'd beg to stay home. And what was I going to do? He'd say, 'Mom, all the kids know what Daddy did. Everybody hates him, and they all hate me, too.' I kept trying to tell him what his dad did had nothing to do with him. It was completely separate and had no bearing on him at all. But I couldn't talk him into it. He never bought it for a minute. And honestly, kids did seem to pick on him. Pretty soon he was getting into horrible fights, cutting classes, skipping school, vandalism, petty theft. It was a nightmare."
She tapped her cigarette against the already laden ashtray, flicking a quarter inch of ash into a tiny crevice between butts. "What about Michael?"
"He was just the opposite. Sometimes I think Michael used school as a way of blotting out the truth. Brian was oversensitive, where Michael made himself numb. We talked to school counselors, teachers. I don't know how many social workers we saw. Everybody had a theory, but nothing seemed to work. I didn't have the money to get us any real help. Brian was so bright, and he seemed so capable. It just broke my heart. Of course, in many ways, Wendell was like that, too. Anyway, I didn't want the boys to believe he killed himself. He wouldn't do that. We had a good marriage, and he adored them. He was very family-oriented. You can ask anyone. I was sure he'd never deliberately do anything to hurt us. I've always believed Carl Eckert was the one who was fiddling with the books. Maybe Wendell couldn't face it. I'm not saying he didn't have his weaknesses. He wasn't perfect, but he tried."
I let that one sit there, unwilling to challenge her version of events. I could see her faltering attempt to correct the family story. The dead are always easier to characterize. You can assign them any attitude or motive without fear of contradiction. "I take it the boys are different in more ways than one," I said.
Well, yes, obviously, Michael is the steadier, partly because he's older and feels protective. He's always been a very responsible kid, and thank goodness for that. He was the only one I could depend on after Wendell's... after what happened to Wendell. Especially with Brian so out of control. If Michael has a fault, it's being too earnest. He's always trying to do the right thing. Juliet being a case in point. He didn't have to marry her. I kept myself still, making no response at all, because I realized she was giving me a critical piece of information about the situation. She assumed I was already in possession of the facts. Apparently Juliet was pregnant when Michael married her. She went right on, talking as much to herself as to me. Lord knows she wasn't pushing for it. She wanted to have the baby, and she needed financial help, but it's not like she insisted on making things legal. That was Michael's idea. I'm not sure it was a good one, but they're doing okay. Has it been hard on you to have them living here? She shrugged. For the most part, I've enjoyed it. Juliet gets on my nerves now and then, but mostly because she's so damned uncooperative. She has to do it her way. She's the expert on every subject. This at 18, of course. I know it comes out of her own insecurities, but it's irritating all the same. She can't stand my help, and she can't tolerate suggestions. She doesn't have a clue about motherhood. I mean, she's crazy about the baby, but she treats him like a toy. You ought to see her when she bathes him. It's enough to make your heart fail. She'll leave him lying on the counter while she goes off to get his diapers. It's a wonder he hasn't rolled off half a dozen times. What about Brian? Does he live here as well? He and Michael shared an apartment until this latest incident. Once Brian was sentenced and started serving his time, Michael couldn't afford to keep it. His job didn't pay much, and then with Juliet, he simply couldn't manage. She's insisted on staying home since the day he married her. I noticed how neatly she substituted euphemisms. We were not discussing an unplanned pregnancy, a hasty wedding, and the subsequent financial muddle. Gone were the jail escape and the major shooting spree. These were episodes and incidents, inexplicable occurrences for which neither boy appeared to be responsible. She seemed to pick up on my thought process, quickly shifting the subject. She moved out into the hall and grabbed the vacuum, hauling it in behind her on lustily squeaking casters. My aunt always said a canister vacuum was useless compared with an upright. I wondered if this was the central metaphor in Dana's life. She found the closest electrical outlet and pulled out enough cord to plug it in. Maybe it's my fault, what Brian's been through. God knows being a single parent is the hardest job I've ever faced. When you're penniless at the same time, there's no way you can win. Brian should have had the best. Instead, he's had nothing in the way of counseling. His problems have been compounded, which is hardly his doing. Will you talk to them for me? I don't want to interfere, but I'm going to have to talk to Brian. Why? What for? If Wendell shows up, it's got nothing to do with him. Maybe so, maybe not. The shooting in Mexicali was all over the news. I know Wendell read the papers down in Viento Negro. It seems reasonable to imagine he'd head back in this direction.
You don't know that for a fact.
No, but just suppose it's true. Don't you think Brian should be told what's going on? You don't want him doing something foolish. She seemed to take that in. I could see her turning over the possibilities. She removed the upholstery attachment and clicked the rug and floor nozzle into place, adding the extension wand in preparation for vacuuming.
Hell, why not? Things couldn't get much worse.
The poor kid, she said. I thought it better not to mention that I was picturing him like a piece of bait in a trap. In the office alcove below, the phone rang. Dana launched into a description of Brian's misfortunes, but I found myself listening to her canned message as it came wafting up the stairs. The live message followed at the sound of the beep, one of her bridal clients with the latest complaint. Hello, Dana. This is Ruth. Listen, hon, Bethany's been having a little problem with this caterer you recommended. We've asked the woman twice for a written cost per person breakdown of the food and drink for the reception, and we can't seem to get a response. We thought maybe you could give her a call and light a little fire under her for answers. I'll be here in the morning and you can call me, okay? Thank you. I'll talk to you then, babe. Bye now. I wondered idly if Dana ever told these young brides the problems they were going to run into once the wedding was over with. Boredom, weight gain, irresponsibility, friction over sex, spending family holidays and who picks up the socks. Maybe it was just my basic cynicism rising to the surface, but cost per person food and drink breakdowns
seemed trivial compared to the conflicts marriage generated.
A real helper, generous, cooperative, winsome and funny. He's got a very high IQ.
She was talking about Brian, the alleged teen killer. Only a mother could describe as winsome and funny a kid who'd recently broken out of jail and gone on a killing rampage. She was looking at me expectantly.
I have to get on with this so I can reclaim my bedroom. You have any other questions before I get on with the vacuuming?
Offhand, I couldn't think of any.
This is fine for now.
She kicked the switch and the vacuum cleaner shrilled to life. 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 A high keening whine that drowned out any possibility of conversation. As I let myself out the front door, I could hear the droning of the motor as she hauled the suction wand across the floor. Chapter 11. My watch showed that it was nearly noon. I drove over to the Perdido County Jail. The Perdido County Government Center was constructed in 1978, a sprawling mass of pale concrete that houses the Criminal Justice Center, the Administration Building, and the Hall of Justice. I parked my car in one of the spaces provided in the vast marina of asphalt that surrounds the complex. I went into the main entrance, pushing through the glass doors that opened onto the lower lobby. I hung a right. The main jail public counter was located down a short hallway. On the same floor were the sheriff's personnel counter, records and licensing, and the West County Patrol Services counter, none of which interested me for the moment. I identified myself to the civilian clerk, and in due course was directed to the watch commander's office, where I introduced myself. I showed my identification, including my driver's license and my investigator's license. There was a brief delay while a second clerk picked up the phone and checked to see if the jail administrator was in. The minute I heard the guy's name, I knew my luck had improved. I had gone to high school with Tommy Reichman. He was 2 years ahead of me, but we'd misbehaved together rather desperately in the days when one could do that without risking death or disease. I wasn't sure he'd remember me, but apparently he did. Sergeant Reichman agreed to see me as soon as I'd received my clearance. I was directed down the hall to his small office on the right. As I entered his office, he unfolded himself from his swivel chair, emerging to an impressive 6'8", his face wreathed with a grin.
"Well, it's been way too long. How the hell are you?"
"I'm great, Tommy. How are you?"
We shook hands across the desk and made effusive noises at each other, trading hasty summaries of the year since we'd met. He was now in his mid-30s, clean-shaven, with glossy brown hair, parted on one side and slicked across. His hair was thinning slightly, and his forehead was scored as if by the tines of a fork. He wore glasses with wire frames, and his jaw looked like it would smell of citrus aftershave. His khaki Sheriff's Department uniform was starched and crisply pressed, the slacks looking like they'd been professionally tailored to fit. He had long arms and big hands. A wedding ring, of course. Wedding ring, of course. Wedding ring, of course. Wedding ring, of course. Wedding ring. He motioned me to a chair and then eased back into his own.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
He motioned me to a chair and then eased back into his own. Even seated, he had the build of a basketball player, his grasshopper knees visible above the edge of the desk. His black shoes must have been a size 13. His accent was still shaded by a touch of the Midwest, Wisconsin perhaps, and I remembered that he'd arrived at Santa Teresa High halfway through the school year. He had a studio portrait on his desk, a wifey-looking woman and three medium-aged kids, two boys and a girl, all with glossy brown hair neatly slicked down with water, all wearing glasses with clear plastic frames. Two of the kids were of an age where they had goofy teeth.
"You're here with regard to Brian Jaffe."
"More or less," I replied. "I'm actually more interested in the whereabouts of his father."
"So I understand. Lieutenant Whiteside told me what was going on."
"Are you familiar with the case? I've heard some of it, but nothing in any depth."
"A good old buddy of mine worked with Lieutenant Brown on that case, so I had him fill me in. Just about everybody down here knows that one. Lot of local citizens got sucked into CSL. Lost their shirts, most of them. Sometimes I think it was a textbook scam.
My buddy's transferred since then, but Harris Brown's the one you want to talk to if we can't help.
I've been trying to get in touch with him, but I was told he retired.
He did, but I'm sure he'd be willing to help any way he can. Does the kid know there's a chance his dad's still alive?
I shook my head. I just talked to his mother, and she hasn't told him yet. I understand he was just brought back to Perdido.
That's right. Over the weekend, we dispatched a couple of deputies to Mexicali, where the kid was handed over. He was transported by car up here to the main jail. He was booked in last night.
Any chance I might see him?
Not today, I don't think. Inmate mealtime at the moment, and after that he's scheduled for a medical exam. You can try tomorrow or the next day, as long as he has no objections.
How'd he manage to escape from Connett?
Reichman stirred restlessly, breaking off eye contact. We're not going to talk about that, he said. Next thing you know, the information ends up in the paper, and then everybody gets it down. Let's just say the inmates discovered a little quirk in the system and took advantage of it. It won't happen again, I can tell you that.
Will he be tried as an adult?
Tommy Reichman did a stretch, extending his arms above his head with a series of popping sounds. You'd have to ask the DA, though personally I'd sure like to see it. This kid is devious. We think he was the one who cooked up the escape plan to begin with, but who's going to contradict him at this point? Two guys are dead and the third's in critical condition. He'll claim he's the innocent victim. You know how it goes. These kids never take responsibility. His mother's already hired him a high-priced attorney, bringing some guy up from Los Angeles.
Probably utilizing some of the benefits from his father's life insurance policy, I said. I'd love to see Wendell Jaffe make a discreet appearance.
I can't believe he'd risk it, but it would sure verify my intuitions. Well, now, I'll tell you the problem you're going to have with that. Case like this, a lot of notoriety, courtrooms probably going to be closed and under tight security. You know how it goes. Kid's attorney's going to offer up spirited arguments, asserting his client's fitness for treatment under juvenile court law. He'll want a probation officer to investigate. He'll want reports submitted with other relevant evidence. He'll raise six kinds of hell, and until the matter's decided, he'll maintain his client is entitled to protection under juvenile statutes.
I don't suppose there's any way I'd be given access to his juvenile criminal history, I said.
I was stating the obvious, but sometimes a cop will surprise you.
Sergeant Reichman laced his hands across his head, smiling at me with a sort of brotherly indulgence.
We wouldn't do that regardless, he said mildly. You can always try the paper. Reporters over there can probably get you anything you want. Not sure how they do it, but they have their little ways.
He sat forward on his chair.
I was just on my way to lunch. You want to join me in the cafeteria?
Sure, I'd like that, I said. On his feet again, I realized how much he'd grown since I'd seen him last, and he was over 6 feet tall then. Now he was stoop-shouldered and seemed to carry his head tilted to one side, perhaps hoping to avoid being knocked silly by the door frame when he entered or left a room. I would have bet money his wife was only 5 feet tall and spent her life with his belt buckle staring her in the face. On a dance floor, the two probably looked as though they were engaged in an obscene act.
If you don't mind, I got a few things to take care of on the way.
Fine with me, I said.
We began to traverse the maze of corridors linking the various offices and departments, moving through a series of security checkpoints, like the airlocks on a spaceship. There were video cameras sweeping every corridor, and I knew we were being observed by the deputy manning Level 1 control. The smells changed subtly from one area to the next. Food, bleach, burning chemicals, as if someone had set fire to the plastic ring on a six-pack of canned sodas, musty blankets, floor wax, rubber tires. Sergeant Reichman conducted a couple of administrative transactions, apparently minor matters fraught with clerical jargon. There were a surprising number of women working in the processing unit, all ages, all sizes, usually in jeans or polyester pants. There was a nice air of camaraderie among the people I observed. Lots of telephones ringing, lots of movement from department to department as we cruised through. Finally, he steered us toward the small employee cafeteria. The menu for the deputies that day was lasagna, grilled ham and cheese sandwiches, French fries, and corn. Not quite enough fat and carbs for my taste, but it was coming close.
There was also a salad bar, featuring stainless steel bins of chopped iceberg lettuce, sliced carrots, green pepper rings, and onions. For drinks, one had a choice of orange juice, lemonade, or cartons of milk. The prisoner's menu was listed on the board above the hot table. Bean soup, grilled ham and cheese sandwiches, beef stroganoff or lasagna, white bread, French fries, and the ubiquitous corn. Unlike the meals at the jail in Santa Teresa, which were served cafeteria style, the food here was prepared and dished out by inmates onto trays that were loaded in turn into big stainless steel hot carts. I'd seen several being rolled into the industrial-size elevators en route to jail levels 3 and 4. Reichman still had the unruly hunger of an adolescent. I watched him pile his tray with a serving of lasagna the size of a brick, 2 grilled sandwiches, a mound each of corn and French fries, and a hefty side of salad with a dipper of Thousand Island dressing poured on top. He tucked 2 cartons of low-fat milk into the remaining space on his tray. I followed him in the line, picking up plastic flatware from a bin. I opted for a grilled ham and cheese sandwich and a modest log pile of fries, hungrier than I thought possible given the institutional nature of the setting. We found a free corner table and unloaded our trays. "Were you working in Perdido when Wendell formed CSL?" I asked. "You bet," Reichman said. "Course, I never invest in deals like that myself. My dad always told me I was better off with my money stashed in a coffee can. Depression mentality, but it's not bad advice. Actually, you better hope the word on Jaffe doesn't get out. I know a couple deputies lost money on that scam. He shows his face, you're going to have a posse of irate citizens riding down on that dude." "What's the deal?" I asked. "I don't understand what these guys are about." He squirted ketchup on his fries and passed the dispenser to me. I could tell we shared the same intense interest in junk food. Reichman ate quickly, attention focused on his plate as the mountain of food diminished. "System works on trust. Checks, credit cards, a contract of any kind. People perpetrating fraud feel no inner moral obligation to make good on their agreements. They operate along a continuum that runs from financial irresponsibility to civil consumer puffing to fraud to criminal lies. You see it all the time. Bankers, real estate brokers, investment counselors, anyone exposed to large sums of cash. After a while, they can't seem to keep their hands off it." "Too tempting," I remarked. I wiped my hands on a paper napkin, uncertain whether the grease was coming from the sandwich or the pile of French fries. Both were heaven to a person of my low appetites. "It's more than that, because it's not just bucks these boys are after, as far as I can tell. The money's just a way of keeping score, like they say. You watch these guys operate, and pretty soon you realize it's the game they get off on. Same goes for politicians. It's a power trip. Us ordinary mortals are just fuel for their egos." "I'm surprised anyone in law enforcement fell for his scheme. You guys ought to know better. You probably see enough of it." He shook his head, chewing on a bite of sandwich. "Always hope to make a killing. A little something for nothing, and I guess we're not above it." "I had a conversation with Jaffe's ex-partner last night," I said. "He seemed pretty slick." "He is. Went right back into business, and what the hell are we going to do? Everybody around here knows the guy went to jail. Day he comes out, they're ready to invest again. What makes these cases so hard to prosecute is the victims don't want to believe they've been deceived. The victims all become dependent on the crook who's cheating them. Once they invest, they need him to be successful to get their money back. Then, of course, the con man always has last-minute excuses, stalling repayment and dragging his feet. Case like that is a bitch to prove. Lot of time the DA can't even get corroboration. I really don't understand it when smart guys get into stuff like this. You look back far enough, you could probably see it coming. You know, old Wendell's got a law degree, but he never passed the bar."
"Really? That's interesting."
"Yeah, he got into some trouble just out of law school, and he ended up letting the whole business drop. He's just one of those guys. Smart and well-educated, but he had a bad streak that showed up even then."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Some prostitute died in the course of rough sex. Jaffe was the John, pleaded down on a charge of manslaughter, and got off on probation. It all got hushed up, of course, but it was ugly stuff. There's no way you practice law with that in your background.
Perdido's too small.
He could have gone somewhere else.
He didn't seem to think so.
Seems weird somehow. I haven't been thinking of him as the violent type. How'd he get from manslaughter to fraud?
Wendell Jaffe's sly in more ways than one. It's not like the guy lived in a 4,000-square-foot house complete with swimming pool and tennis court. He bought a nice 3-bedroom tract house in a good middle-class neighborhood. He and his wife drove American cars, the stripped-down economy models, and not like new ones. His was 6 years old. Both of his sons went to public schools. Usually with these guys, what you'll see is a pattern of conspicuous consumption. But Wendell didn't do that. No designer clothes. He and Dana didn't travel much or entertain lavishly. From the point of view of his investors, and this was something he was quick to assure them, he poured every penny right back into the business.
What was the gimmick? How'd they pull it off?
Well, I did a little digging when I heard you were coming down. From what I understand, it was pretty straightforward. He and Eckert had about 250 investors, some of them putting up $25,000 to $50,000 apiece. CLS took fees and royalties off the top.
On the basis of a prospectus?
That's right. First thing Jaffe did, he bought a shell of a company and renamed it CSL Inc.
What kind of company?
This was trust deed investment. Then he made headlines with the purchase of a $102 million complex, which he announced he had sold 6 months later for $189 million. Truth was, the deal never went through, but the public didn't know that. Wendell hands his investors this impressive-looking, unaudited financial statement showing assets in excess of $25 million. After that, it was a piece of cake. They'd buy real estate and show a paper profit by selling it back to another of their shell companies, inflating the value of the property in the process.
Jesus, I said.
It was a typical Ponzi. Some of the people who came on board early were making out like bandits, returns of 28% on their initial investment. It wasn't unusual to see them turn around and invest twice that sum, cashing in on the bonanza of CSL's financial savvy. Who could resist? Jaffe seemed to be earnest, knowledgeable, hard-working, sincere, conservative. There was nothing flamboyant about the man. He paid good salaries and treated his employees decently. He seemed happily married, devoted to his family. He was a bit of a workaholic, but he managed to take occasional time off. 2 weeks in May on his annual fishing trip, another 2 weeks in August when he took the family camping.
God, you really do know this stuff. What about Carl? How'd he fit into this?
Wendell was the front man. Carl did everything else. Wendell's talent was the hustle, which he did with a kind of low-key, drop-dead sincerity that made you want to pull your wallet out and give him everything you had. The two of them put together various real estate syndicates. Investors were told their money would be held in a separate account, devoted exclusively to a particular project. In actual fact, the funds for the various projects were commingled, and some funds intended for a new project were used to complete the old.
And then the bottom dropped out of the market.
Tommy feigned a slam dunk and pointed a finger at me. You got it. CSL suddenly began to have trouble finding new investors. Eventually, Jaffe must have realized the whole house of cards was collapsing. He also got a notice about an IRS audit, from what I hear tell. That's when he went off on his trip. I'll tell you one thing. This guy was so persuasive that even when it became apparent the investors had lost their shirts, a lot of people still believed in him, convinced that there was some other explanation for the missing funds, which is where Carl Eckert really ate the big one.
Did Eckert realize what he was doing?
If you want my opinion, he did. He's claimed all along he had no idea what Wendell was up to. But Eckert himself did the nuts and bolts end of the business, so he must have been aware. Hell, he had to know. He just maintained his innocence because there wasn't anyone to contradict him.
Same thing the Jaffe kid is pulling now, I said.
Tony smiled. In matters like this, it always helps if your confederates are dead.
It was 1:15 when I left the building, zigzagging my way across the crowded lot to the far corner where I'd parked. Once I left the complex of government offices, I hung a left, heading back toward 101, managing to catch every traffic light between me and the freeway. At every stop, it amused me to watch women drivers take advantage of the moment to check their eye makeup and fluff their hair. I adjusted my rearview mirror, taking a quick look at the state of my own mop. I was nearly certain the little spiky patch near my left ear had grown some. Almost inadvertently, I glanced at the car behind me. I got a quick hit of adrenaline, as though a hot wire had touched me. Renata was at the wheel, frowning slightly, her attention focused on her mobile phone. She was alone in the car, which didn't look like a rental, unless, of course, Avis and Hertz have taken to using Jaguars for their full size. The light changed, and I pulled away with Renata right behind me, moving at the same pace. I was in the inside lane of two, moving in a southerly direction. She angled into the curb lane, her speed picking up as she passed me on the right. I saw her right rear turn signal start to blink. I eased into the curb lane, taking my place behind her, trying to anticipate what she meant to do. A large shopping mall loomed up on our right. I saw her turn in, but before I could do likewise, someone cut in front of me. I braked abruptly, trying to avoid rear-ending the other driver while I scanned the parking lot ahead. Renata had taken a quick left, and then turned down the second aisle, which seemed to extend the entire length of the mall. I turned into the entrance a full minute behind her. I sped through the parking lot on a parallel course, flying over speed bumps like a skier taking moguls. I kept thinking she would park, but she continued along the same path. There were two rows of cars between us, but in the one clear glimpse I caught, she was still on the phone. Whatever her conversation, she must have changed her mind about shopping. I saw her lean to the right, apparently replacing the handset. The next thing I knew, she reached an exit and took a left, easing into the flow of traffic again. I cut out at the exit, falling into the same lane as Renata, only two cars back. I didn't think she'd spotted me, and I wasn't sure she'd recognize me in a setting so different from the one in which she'd last seen me. She passed the directional sign for Highway 101, cranking up her speed when she hit the on-ramp. The driver in front of me began to slow. "Go on, go on," I was urging under my breath. The guy was old and cautious, swinging wide to the left for a right-hand turn into the gas station on the corner. By the time I whipped around him and up the ramp, Renata's Jaguar was no longer visible among the speeding northbound cars. She was the kind of driver who shot any gap she saw, and she'd apparently zigzagged her way out of sight. I drove the next 25 miles, straining for sight of her, but she was gone, gone, gone. I realized belatedly that I had missed the opportunity to pick off the numbers on her license plate. The only comfort I took was in the simple assumption that if Renata was in the area, Wendell Jaffe probably wasn't far away. Chapter 12. Back in Santa Teresa, I went straight to the office, where I hauled out my portable Smith Corona and typed up my notes, recording the events of the past 2 days, as well as names, addresses, and miscellaneous data. Then I calculated the time I'd put in and tacked on gasoline and mileage. I was probably going to bill CF at a flat rate of $50 an hour, but I wanted to have an itemized accounting ready in case Gordon Titus turned all prissy and authoritarian. Down deep, I knew this rapt attention to the paperwork was only a thinly disguised cover for my mounting excitement. Wendell had to be close by, but what was he doing, and what would it take to bring him into the light? At least the Renata sighting had confirmed my hunch, unless the two of them had split up, which didn't seem likely. He had family here. I wasn't sure she did. On an impulse, I checked the local telephone directory, but there were no Huffs listed. Hers was probably an alias, just as his name was. I would have given just about anything to lay eyes on the man, but that was beginning to feel about as likely as a UFO sighting. At this stage of any investigation, I'm inclined to impatience. It always feels the same way to me, as though this is the case that's finally going to do me in. So far, I haven't blown a gig. I don't always succeed in ways that I anticipate, but I haven't yet failed to bring a case to resolution. The problem with being a PI is there isn't any rule book. There's no set procedure, no company manual, and no prescribed strategy. Every case is different, and every investigator ends up flying by the seat of her or his pants. If you're doing a background check, you can always make the rounds, looking up deeds, titles, births and deaths, marriages, divorces, credit information, business and criminal records. Any competent detective quickly learns how to follow the trail of paper breadcrumbs left by the private citizen wandering in the bureaucratic forest. But the success of a missing person's search depends on ingenuity, persistence, and just plain old dumb luck. The leads you develop are based on personal contact, and you better be good at reading human nature while you're at it. I sat and thought about what I'd learned so far. It really wasn't much, and I didn't feel I was any closer to homing in on Wendell Jaffe. I began to transcribe my notes onto index cards. If all else failed, maybe I could shuffle them and deal myself a game of solitaire. The next time I looked up, it was 4:35. My Spanish class met on Tuesday afternoons from 5 until 7 o'clock. I really didn't need to leave for another 15 minutes, but I'd exhausted my little storehouse of clerical skills. I slipped the paperwork in a folder and locked the file cabinet. I locked the office door behind me, went out through the side door and down the stairs. I had to stand on the street corner for a good 60 seconds, trying to remember where I'd parked my car. It finally occurred to me, and I was just setting off when I heard Allison yoo-hooing from the window.
"Kinsey!"
I shaded my eyes against the late afternoon sun. She was on the little third-floor balcony outside John Ives's office, blonde hair hanging over the railing like a latter-day Rapunzel.
"Lieutenant Whiteside's on the line. You want me to take a message?"
"Yes, if you would, or he can call my machine and leave a message himself. I'm going off to class, but I'll be home by 7:30. If he wants me to call back, ask him to leave me a number." She nodded and waved, disappearing from sight. I retrieved my car and drove over to the adult ed facility, which was 2 miles away. Vera Lipton pulled into the parking lot, arriving shortly after I did. She turned into the first half-empty aisle on her right. I'd eased into the second aisle on the left, parking closer to the classroom. Both of us were testing theories about how to make the quickest getaway once Spanish class ended. Most of the available classrooms had been pressed into service, and there were anywhere from 150 to 200 students piling into cars at the same time. I grabbed my legal pad, my pile of papers, and my copy of 501 Spanish Verbs. I locked the car in haste and made a diagonal cut across the parking lot, intercepting Vera. We'd first met when I was still doing periodic investigations for California Fidelity Insurance, where she was employed as an adjuster, later promoted to claims manager. She's probably as close to a best friend as I'll ever have, though I don't really know what such a relationship entails. Now that we no longer have adjacent offices, our contact has taken on a catch-as-catch-can quality. This was one reason taking a class together seemed so appealing. During the break, we'd do a fast personal update. Sometimes she'd invite me over for supper after class, and we'd end up laughing and chatting into the night. After 37 years of dedicated singlehood, she'd married a family practice physician named Neil Hess, whom she'd tried to fix me up with the year before. What amused me at the time was that I could tell she was smitten, though she'd decided he was inappropriate for reasons I thought bogus. Specifically, she seemed to object to the fact that she was nearly 6 inches taller. In the end, love won out. Or maybe Neil got lifts. They'd been married now for 9 months, since the previous Halloween, and I'd never seen her looking better. She's a big gal to begin with, maybe 5'10", 140 pounds on a good-sized frame. She'd never been apologetic about her generous proportions. The truth was, men seemed to regard her as some sort of goddess, striking up conversations with her everywhere she went. Now that she and Neil were working out together, jogging and playing tennis, she'd dropped 15 pounds. Her once dyed red hair had grown out to its natural color, a honeyed brown that she was wearing shoulder length. She still dressed like a flight instructor, jumpsuits with padded shoulders and tinted aviator glasses, sometimes with spike heels, tonight with boots. When she caught sight of me, she whipped off her glasses and stuck them upright on her head like a prescription tiara. She waved enthusiastically. "Hola," she called in merry Spanish tones. So far, this was the only word we'd really mastered, and we used it on each other as often as we could. Some guy clipping the hedges looked up expectantly, probably thinking that Vera was addressing him. "Hola," I replied. "¿Dónde están los gatos?" Still in search of those elusive black cats.
"En los árboles,"
Muy bueno, I said. God, doesn't that sound great?
Yeah, I'm almost sure that guy over there thinks we're Hispanic, I said.
Vera grinned, flashing him a thumbs up before she turned back to me.
You're here early for a change. You usually come flying in 15 minutes late.
I was doing some paperwork and couldn't wait to quit. How are you? You look great.
We strolled into class, absorbed in chit-chat and idle gossip, until the instructor arrived. Patty Abkin-Quiroga is petite and enthusiastic, amazingly tolerant of our clumsy lurches through the language. There's nothing so humbling as being a dunce in a foreign tongue, and if it weren't for her compassion, we'd have lost heart after 2 weeks. As usual, she started the class by regaling us with a long tale in Spanish, something to do with her activities that day. Either she ate a tostado, or her little boy Eduardo flushed his baby bottle down the toilet, and she had to have the plumber come out and take a look. When I got home after class and let myself into my apartment, I could see the message light blinking on my answering machine. I pressed the button and listened as I moved around my tiny living room, turning on lights.
Hello, Kinsey. Lieutenant Whiteside over at Santa Teresa Police Department. I got a fax this afternoon from our pals in the Los Angeles Passport Office. They don't show anything on Dean DeWitt Huff, but they do have a record of a Renata Huff at the following address in Perdido.
I snatched up a pen and scribbled a note on a paper napkin while he was reciting the particulars.
If I'm not mistaken, that's over in the Perdido Keys. Let me know what you find out. I'm off tomorrow, but I'll be back on Thursday.
I said, "All right," giving both raised fists a shake. I did a quick dance, complete with butt wiggles, thanking the universe for small favors. I dumped my plans for dinner at Rosie's. Instead, I made myself a peanut butter and pickle sandwich on whole wheat bread, wrapping it in waxed paper, and then sealing it in a plastic bag the way my aunt had taught me. In addition to the preservation of fresh sandwiches, my other notable household skill, thanks to her odd notions, is the ability to gift wrap and tie a package of any size without the use of scotch tape or stickers. This she considered essential preparation for life. It was 10 of 8 and still light out when I hit the 101 again. I ate my laptop picnic, steering with one hand, while I held my sandwich with the other, humming to myself as the flavors mingled on my tongue. My car radio had been ominously silent for days, and I suspected some relevant fuse had given up the ghost deep inside. I flipped the on button anyway, on the off chance it had somehow healed itself in my absence. No such luck. I flipped the radio off, amusing myself instead with recollections of the annual celebration of Perdido Olvidado Township history, which consisted of a dispirited parade, the erection of many food booths, and the local citizens walking listlessly about, spilling mustard and hot dog relish on their P.O. T-shirts. Father Junipero Serra, who was the first president of the Alta California Missions, established 9 missions along a 650-mile stretch of California coastland between San Diego and Sonoma. Father Fermin Lasuen, who assumed leadership in 1785, the year after Sarah's death, founded 9 more missions. There were other less luminous mission presidents, countless friars and padres whose names have vanished from public awareness. One of these, Father Prospero Olivares, petitioned in early 1781 to build 2 small sister missions on the Santa Clara River. Father Olivares argued that adjacent presidios, or forts, established on dual sites, would not only serve as protection for the proposed mission to be built in Santa Teresa, but could simultaneously convert, shelter, and train scores of California Indians who could then serve as skilled laborers for the projected construction process. Father Junipero Serra greatly favored the idea and granted enthusiastic approval. Extensive drawings were submitted, and the site was dedicated. However, a series of frustrating and inexplicable delays resulted in postponement of the groundbreaking until after Serra's death, at which point the plan was quashed. Father Olivares' twin churches were never built. Some historians have portrayed Olivares as both worldly and ambitious, positing that the withdrawal of support for his project was intended to subdue his unbecoming secular aspirations. Ecclesiastical documents that have since come to light suggest another possibility,
that Father Lasuen, who was championing the establishment of missions at Soledad, San Jose, San Juan Batista, and San Miguel, saw Olivares as a threat to the achievement of his own aims, and deliberately sabotaged his efforts until after Father Serra's demise. His own subsequent rise to power was the death knell of Olivares's vision. Whatever the truth, cynical observers renamed the dual sites Perdido Olvidado, a mongrelization of Prospero Olivares's name. Translated from the Spanish, the names mean lost and forgotten. This trip, I bypassed the main business district. The architecture in the town itself was a mix of boxy, blocky, modern buildings interspersed with Victorian structures. On the far side of 101, between the freeway and the ocean, there were whole sections of the land entirely covered with blacktop, a series of interconnecting parking lots for supermarkets, gas stations, and fast food establishments. One could drive for blocks through linked acres of asphalt without ever actually going out onto a city street. I took the Sea Cove off-ramp, heading for the Perdido Keys. Closer to the ocean, the houses seemed to take on the look of a little beach town, board and batten with big decks, painted sea blue and gray, the yards filled with impossibly bright purple, yellow, and orange flowers. I passed a house where there were so many wetsuits hung to dry on a second-story balcony that it looked as if the guests from a cocktail party had wandered out on the deck for air. Daylight had faded to indigo, and all the house lights in the neighborhood were coming on when I finally located the street I was looking for. The houses on both sides of this narrow lane backed onto the quays, long fingers of seawater stretching back from the ocean. The rear of each house seemed to boast a wide wooden deck with a short wood ramp leading down to a dock, the channel itself deep enough to admit sizable boats. I could smell the cool marina cologne, and the quiet was underscored by an occasional slap of water and the chorusing of frogs. I cruised slowly, squinting at house numbers, finally spotting the address Whiteside had given me. Renata Huff's house was a two-story dark blue stucco with white trim. The roof was wood shake, and the rear portion of the property was shielded from the street by a white board fence. The house was dark, and a for sale sign hung from a post in the front yard. I said, "Well, damn it." I parked the car across the street and approached the house, moving up a long wooden ramp to the front door. I rang the bell as if I expected to be admitted. I didn't see a lockbox from the real estate company, which might mean that Renata was still in residence. Casually, I checked the houses on either side of hers. One was dark, and the other showed lights only at the rear. I turned then so I could scrutinize the houses across the street. As nearly as I could tell, I wasn't under observation, and there didn't seem to be any vicious dogs on the premises. Often I consider this a tacit invitation to break and enter, but I had spied through one of the two narrow windows flanking the front door, the telltale dot of red light, denoting an alarm system, armed and ready. This was not gracious behavior on Renata's part. Now what? I had the option to get back in my car and return to Santa Teresa, but I hated to admit I'd made the trip for naught. I glanced over at the house to the right of Renata's. Through a side window, I could see a woman in her kitchen, head bent to some domestic chore. I walked down the ramp and crossed the yard, trying to avoid the flower beds as I made my way to the door. I rang the bell, staring with idle curiosity at Renata's front porch. Even as I watched, her burglar-fooling lights came on. Now it looked like an empty house filled with pointlessly burning lamps. Somebody flipped on the porch light overhead and opened the door to the length of the chain. "Yes." The woman was probably in her 40s. All I could see of her was her long, dark, curly hair that cascaded past her shoulders, like the wig on a decadent 17th-century fop. She smelled like flea soap. I thought at first it was some new designer perfume until I noticed the towel-swaddled dog she was toting under her arm. It was one of those little brown and black jobs about the size of a loaf of bread. Muffin. Buffy. Princess. I said, "Hi, I wonder if you can give me some information about the house for sale next door? I noticed the outside ramp. Do you happen to know if the place is equipped for the handicapped?" "Yes, it is." I was hoping for a little more in the way of information.
On the inside, too?
That's right. Her husband suffered a real bad stroke about 10 years ago, a month before they started work on the house. She had the contractor adjust all the plans for wheelchair access, including a lift up to the second floor.
Amazing, I murmured.
My sister's in a wheelchair, and we've been looking for a place that would accommodate her disability. Since I couldn't see the woman's face, I found myself addressing my remarks to the dog, who really seemed quite attentive. The woman said,
"Really? What's wrong with her?"
"She was in a diving accident 2 years ago, and she's paralyzed from the waist down."
"That's too bad," she said.
Her tone suggested the sort of fake concern a stranger's story generates. I could have bet she was formulating questions she was too polite to ask. Actually, I was beginning to feel pretty bad about Sis myself, though she sounded brave.
"She's doing pretty well. She's adjusted, at any rate. We were driving around today checking out the neighborhood. We've been house hunting now for what seems like ages, and this is the first that's really sparked her interest, so I told her I'd stop by and ask. Do you have any idea what they're asking for the place?"
I heard $495.
"Really? Well, that's not bad. I think I'll have our real estate agent set up an appointment to show us through. Is the owner home during the day?"
"That's hard to say. Lately she's been out of town quite a lot."
"What's her name again?" I asked, as if she'd told me once.
"Renata Huff."
"What about her husband?" "If she's not home, could I have the agent give him a call instead?"
"Oh, sorry. Dean died, Mr. Huff. I thought I mentioned he had a heart attack."
The dog began to wiggle, bored with all this talk that didn't directly relate to him.
"That's awful," I said. "How long ago was that?"
"I don't know. Probably 5 or 6 years."
"And she hasn't remarried?"
"She never seemed to have the interest, which is surprising. I mean, she is young, in her 40s, and she comes from a lot of money. At least, that's the story I heard."
The dog began to lick upward, trying to hit the woman's mouth. This might have been some kind of doggy signal, but I wasn't sure what it meant. Kiss, eat, get down, stop.
"I wonder why she wants to sell. Is she leaving the area?"
"I really couldn't say, but if you want to leave me your number, the next time I see her, I can tell her you stopped by."